Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram Weekend Edition, Saturday, March 19th, 2022, Section A. Exec says volatility in prices to persist. Of Mella McEwen. Commodity prices continued their roller coaster ride, swinging between concern about supply shortages caused in large part by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and concerns about falling demand as China has locked down millions in a renewed COVID-19 outbreak. West Texas Intermediate fell 3 of 5 trading days on the New York Merc, starting with a combined $13 loss Monday and Tuesday, and falling to $95.04 on Wednesday. Prices then rebounded, adding about $8 Thursday and adding an additional $1.72 on Friday to close the week at $104.70. Natural gas prices also fell 3 of 5 trading days to end the week with a gain at 18 cents and 24 cent jumps Wednesday and Thursday were sufficient to overcome the declines. The price closed the week at 4.863. Volatility is here to stay, Ryan Lance, chairman and chief executive order of ConocoPhillips, told the Reporter-Telegram. I don't know what the price will do. It will go up and it will go down, and not necessarily in that order. Be prepared for volatility to stay. Geopolitical tensions prompted the U.S. Energy Information Administration to raise its price forecast for both WTI and Brent in its March 22 short-term energy outlook, which the agency finalized March 3rd. The forecast for WTI was raised to average 113 in March and 112 in the second quarter. The average price of Brent was raised to 116 for the second quarter. Our forecast is subject to heightened levels of uncertainty due to various factors, including Russia's further invasion of Ukraine, government-issued limitations on energy imports from Russia, Russian petroleum production, and global crude oil demand. The agency also increased its forecast for the retail price of gasoline, which is now expected to average about $4.10 per gallon through the second quarter, and then decline the rest of the year. The outlook calls for U.S. gasoline to average $4 for the rest of March and rise to a high of $4.12 in May before gradually declining the remainder of the year. Bloomberg reported that the International Energy Agency said Friday oil markets are in an emergency situation that could get worse days after stating that the potential loss of Russian oil exports cannot be understated in its monthly report. Leroy named as award finalist. Reporter-Telegram sports editor Oscar Leroy is one of 8 finalists for the Putt Powell Sports Writer of the Year Award, which is given annually by the Texas High School Coaches Association. There are 8 nominees from the different THSCA regions, and the Reporter-Telegram falls in Region 4. This is Oscar's 4th nomination. This is not a surprise that Oscar is again nominated for the Putt Powell honor, said Reporter-Telegram editor Stuart Doreen. He has provided award-winning material for decades and has worked hard to be a media member that coaches around Midland can trust. The last Reporter-Telegram sports reporter to win the Putt Powell Sportsman of the Year award was Terry Williamson. Interestingly, 3 former Telegram staffers are nominated for the award. They're Randy Rosetta of Hub City Preps, Jonathan Hull of the Wichita Falls Times Record, and Lynn Hayward of the Corpus Christi Caller Times. Fatal crash marks another tragedy on area's roadways. 2 crashes, 12 killed, a community connected to both. It was just luck that Andrews County came up as the location of the crash that killed 9, including 6 golfers from the University of the Southwest and their coach. The accident could have happened anywhere along the 95-mile route between Midland and Hobbs, New Mexico. None of those involved in the accident were from Andrews County. The 13-year-old driver of the Dodge truck was identified by the Associated Press as the son of Heinrich Siemens, 38, of Seminole. Siemens also was riding in the Dodge pickup that was heading south on Farm to Market 1788 when, according to the National Transportation Bureau, the front left tire blew, forcing the vehicle to pull hard to the left and cross into the opposite lane, where it struck head-on a passenger van loaded with golfers and towing an 8-foot cargo trailer. The NTSB stated the high-speed collision took place around 8:15 Tuesday in Andrews County, about a half mile north of State Highway 115. I've been in public safety for 39 years, and this is the largest single event we have had with that much loss of life, said Mike Cook. Andrews County Judge Charlie Falcon told the Reporter-Telegram this week he received the first text about the incident Tuesday night, and his mind went to the wreck 4 months earlier in Big Spring when a Midland man, driving on the wrong side of Interstate 20, collided with a motor coach carrying members of the Andrews High School Band. The Andrews community lost its high school band director, Darren Johns, and the driver of the bus, Mark Albert Boswell, in that fiery crash. Falcon also told the Reporter-Telegram he lost both his mother and sister in a car wreck around 2 years ago. After the sheriff notified me later that night, it took a while to go back to sleep, Falcon said. You just think about the families involved and what they're experiencing. Event at the Transportation Safety Board press conference on Thursday, Bruce Landsberg brought up the collision in Big Spring. The board brought a team to West Texas to examine what exactly took place leading up to and after the collision between the Dodge truck and the golf team's van. A preliminary report will be available in 2 to 3 weeks, a final report between 12 to 18 months. Unfortunately, we see way too much of this kind of problem, and for a variety of reasons. Sometimes DUI or DWI, sometimes it's distracted driving, excessive speed, it's all of the above. And as I say, the highways are the only area where we have this kind of difficulty. To kind of put this in context, on the highway, it's 100 people a day that are dying. Every 2 days, we're killing the equivalent of a Boeing 737 crash. Now just think about that. That's what's putting this into perspective. And it's long overdue that we start to do something about it. Cook says that when first responders go to a scene, they attempt to plan for what they're going to see, what resources they'll need, how they will operate, including how they will deal with traffic, onlookers at the scene, who is in jeopardy, and how first responders can help them. The fire marshal said he couldn't go into specifics about the scene of the crash. It's still under investigation. However, the loss of life was as great as Cook has seen, and the two who didn't die at the scene were transported to the Lubbock Hospital in critical condition. How does one prepare for the potential destruction and death that may be at the scene? Cook said the greater challenge is the ability to separate themselves from the event afterward so that they can carry on normally. He described a critical stress debriefing process where first responders have the opportunity to gather together and talk about what they encountered. It doesn't matter if one is a firefighter, justice of the peace, law enforcement, or dispatcher. They have the opportunity to get together in a private setting away from the public or others who did not respond to the event. In that setting, rank doesn't matter. What you did or didn't do doesn't matter. It's a safe place to describe what we saw and how people are feeling, especially ones that had not experienced it before. In many cases, what they are experiencing is normal. Debriefing, he said, gives people the time to say what they're feeling, and in the case of Tuesday's crash, a major event, everyone will have different feelings about it. Beyond the debriefing, Cook said people keep an eye on each other, look for signs of bigger issues, and, if necessary, help those impacted enough to get professional help. Sadly, it will affect some where they will not want to do this job, Cook said. This is a job we're made for. For some, it's a calling. It is a God call. Economist says domestic energy output should be a national priority. By Mella McEwen. Urge to increase oil and natural gas production to both ensure supplies and ease high energy prices, domestic producers point to a number of constraints keeping them from sharply increasing output. Mark Vintner, senior economist with Wells Fargo, noted that U.S. oil production is down by an average of 1 million barrels a day compared to 2019 levels, suggesting domestic producers have the capability to increase by at least that much. It's hard to ramp up production, he told the Telegram. You increase production where it makes economic sense, and that's the Permian Basin. He reported that production is lagging in nearly every major energy state, including Texas, by far the largest oil producer, where output was averaging 4.7 million barrels a day, down 6.6%. Except production is running 5.8% higher than 2019 levels in the Permian Basin and 2015 average levels. The point of the report is that the U.S. production could be increased to offset the loss of Russian oil if we wanted to, if we had the will. If we made it high enough national priority, we could increase production. All the energy is there and more. We just need the will to get it. The barriers to increasing production are twofold, beginning with the early days of the shale revolution. During the shale revolution, everyone was hell-bent on finding as much oil as they could, as fast as they could, and make money, and a lot of people did. But overall, the industry lost money, prompting investors to demand cash be returned to them rather than put into drilling more wells. We've seen that shake out. We were already seeing more fiscal discipline before the pandemic. Then there's the increased pressure from the environment sector seeking to raise hurdles to oil and gas production. Regulatory hurdles have also risen substantially, which have made it more difficult to secure viable leases for new exploration and stymied investment in energy infrastructure. Once oil is moved out of the ground, it needs to move to refiners for processing, and if that creates a need for pipelines, but those efforts are also stymied. It's safe to say this is not an energy-friendly administration. Part of making energy production a national priority would be to lighten up on regulations. It's frustrating to see prices spike as they have, but oil is a commodity and it's a global commodity. And despite efforts to cool energy prices, I think there's a good chance prices will stay high for a while. I don't see the U.S. lightening up on Russia. The country needs to get real on energy investments. That could take care of the challenges before us and put the U.S. in a stronger position. Hope not yet lost for Towers Project. If your relative lived at Trinity Towers on West Illinois, as ours did, you may have noticed that the buildings seemed to be derelict structures and home to vagrants and cats. It wasn't always that way. In fact, at the turn of the century, it was still a thriving assisted living facility owned by Presbyterian Homes in the heart of the city. Its ambience gave it a vibe like a sorority house for the elderly. Birthday parties occurred frequently in the dining room and rousing games of canasta and chicken foot in the lobby. Once Manor Park's assisted living facility, Helen Greathouse Manor, was completed in 2005, remaining residents were transferred there. Former Manor Park, Inc. President and CEO Alan Hale recalls Trinity Towers had a wonderful history and valued purpose from its opening in 1970 to its closing. We sold it to a group of local investors who soon flipped it to the Midland County Housing Authority, which had hoped to rehabilitate it for low income for the elderly. Staff there said government funding fell through, so in 2018 the Housing Authority sold the property, appraised at $1.7 million, to 2800 West Illinois, based on out of town. The entity's agent is a veteran real estate investor who says he has a big local team and maintains more than 100 other units in our area. With a stated penchant for these types of projects, he filed plans with the city which showed renovations to Tower 1 to provide affordable housing. City staff explained approved plans included the purchase of an adjoining lot for more parking space. The lobby was to be refurbished to hold a catering space, retail area for lease, as well as office area. The second floor living accommodations were to be reconfigured by sealing some doorways to turn individual rooms into two-bedroom units. Open balconies would become private terraces, and each apartment would have a highly efficient Mitsubishi HVAC unit. The contractor brought in a crew from El Paso who moved into some of the adjoining empty fourplexes to perform asbestos abatement in Tower 1 and a gut rehab. A couple of floors were finished. The owner's representative confirmed some of the problems identified by hail included a worn-out roof, old elevators, and cast iron pipes that broke continually. After what the agent estimates to be an investment of a few million dollars, the work paused because of the local economy downturn and COVID pandemic. The ultimate goal is to offer affordable housing in Tower 1, rent those units to get some cash flowing, and then fix up Tower 2, which apparently does not contain asbestos. The owner didn't budge from the project when a potential buyer approached him because he says the buildings are structurally sound, so why would I give it up? I intend to complete it. He may look into the local, state, and federal programs for assistance. Despite the earlier remodel, today many windows are broken and a barbed wire chain-link fence surrounds the two towers. A vandalized car sits in the former courtyard, and the fence has a breach large enough for people and animals to crawl through. When apprised of this, the owner directed some of his team to re-secure the property. Hopefully, as 2022 brings high oil prices, less severe COVID infections, and more growth in Midland, we'll see a brighter future for the old Trinity Towers and another location with affordable rental units for Midlanders in a year or two. Pioneer Natural Resources announced Friday that it would give $20 million in humanitarian aid to relief organizations operating in Ukraine and the surrounding region. Chief Executive Officer Scott Sheffield stated the death and destruction, along with the displacement of millions of Ukrainians caused by Russia's unprovoked invasion, requires assistance from both governments across the world and the global business community. Pioneer and our employees are proud to support our friends in Ukraine. We sincerely hope to see the conflict end as quickly as possible, and our thoughts are with all those impacted. Sherry Lynn Lloyd Parker died February 12th. Memorial is set for March 26th at Ellis Funeral Home at 2 p.m. Alvin Robert Corley passed away on January 21st. A memorial service will be held Friday, April 1st at the Golf Course Road Church of Christ in Midland. Carla Mobley passed away on March 10th. Arrangements were made by Ellis Funeral Home. The family has requested a private gathering in her honor. Gary Paul Hall passed away on February 11th. Graveside services will be at 3 p.m. Saturday, March 26th at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland. Kay Morlock Keating passed away March 10th. No services are scheduled at this time. Norma Jean Satterfield passed away on March 16th. There will be a visitation on Monday, March 21st, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home. A memorial service will be on Tuesday, March 22nd at 2 o'clock at St. Luke's United Methodist Church. Vivian Lee Wood passed away on March 13th. A graveside service will be held Saturday, March 26th, starting at 11 a.m. at Ellis Funeral Home. Dorothy Jean Saws passed away on March 14th. The family will receive guests from 10:30 to 11:30 Saturday, March 26th at Nally Picklem Welsh Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 12 p.m. Saturday, March 26th at the funeral home. When interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Edna Ochoa passed away on March 17th. Viewing will be Sunday, March 20th from 11 to 9 p.m. with a rosary at 7 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will be Monday, March 21st at 10 a.m. at St. Anne's Catholic Church. Arrangements were made with Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. Rosara Magallanes passed away on March 16th. Memorial service will be at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home.
This is Jane reading for the Odessa American on Saturday, March 19th. Chambers plan D.C. fly-in. The Odessa and Midland Chambers of Commerce are collaborating on the Washington fly-in set for March 28th through March 30th. The West Texas delegation, which will include chamber representatives as well as a group from University of Texas Permian Basin, will meet with members of Congress separately and in groups get briefings from U.S. Chamber experts, and have a media panel discussion. Odessa Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Renee Earls said the chambers tie their legislative days in Austin together. She added that neither chamber, individually or collectively, has taken a trip to Washington in many years. Earls said she visits with Midland Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Bobby Burns regularly. "We talk quite a bit about what the two communities can do together," Earls said. Burns said he thought it was important that they do this together. A few years ago, Earls said they met with Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, to discuss transportation issues. Earls said Cornyn made the comment that he comes to the basin a lot and they need to start coming to D.C. Cornyn said individuals had come up, but there wasn't a collective effort. "That planted the seed," she said. And then Bobby called me one day and said, "You know, we're thinking about doing this, but we don't want to do it individually. We want to do it together. So from that point on, great. We are better together," Earls said. There is a tentative agenda for the trip, but she noted that it is fluid. "We did a survey of our membership back in January. Oil and gas was at the top, not to be surprised. And so one of the speakers we wanted to get was the Secretary of Energy. And we still have many, many asks out there. We've not confirmed that, but we're hoping to get somewhere. But of those we have talked to, we're starting out with basically Capitol Hill 101, Earls said. "That will include finding out more about how Washington works, how you as a voter can take a stand on issues that you believe in, that you feel are important, just basic information. Odessa Midland is a very conservative Republican area, and we're going to D.C. where not everyone thinks like we do. But the democratic process has to stand and take place, and we're there waving our own flags for Midland and Odessa, and we need to talk to like-minded people and those who may not agree with us on every issue. Again, that's the democratic process. Democracy at its best. So our committee felt like it was important that we hear from a variety of people that really, bipartisanship, be a big part of this trip," Earls said. "They will meet with U.S. Chamber experts on legislative issues, business in general, and post-pandemic, all that's happening in the world, and getting a perspective from them. Both chambers are members of the U.S. Chamber. We rely on our U.S. Chamber for many resources for our office," Earls said. "They plan to hear from former Ambassador to Mexico, Christopher Landau, at the Capitol Hill Club. Plans are to meet with U.S. Representatives August Pfluger, Jody Arrington of Lubbock, Henry Cuellar of Laredo, and Scott Peters of California. They plan to have lunch with Senator Ted Cruz. They will also have a media discussion moderated by Tatum Hubbard with Paul Kane of the Washington Post, former White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry, and Chad Pegram from Fox News. We're also making some visits to parts of Capitol Hill that we can go into. They do have some restrictions due to COVID. Then there's some free time where individuals can go to whomever's office they wish to go to. We'll be having a reception where we invite the elected officials, as well as their staff, to come meet Odessa Midland representatives and just hear what we have going on in our wonderful economy," Earls said. The Odessa Chamber will be taking about 17 people, but they were still recruiting. Burns noted that the two chambers going to D.C. together can project strength in Midland numbers. The Midland Chamber is bringing about 30 people. "I think the timing is very, very interesting with the Ukrainian issue and the price of oil and gas," Burns said. "We've got a really good agenda and good meeting set. But it's expensive. It's difficult. It's challenging to pull all these meetings together because everyone's so busy in D.C. So we've delayed, and we've been working on it for 4 or 5 years," Burns said. The most recent plan had been in the works for 6 to 9 months. "We want to highlight this Permian energy industry, talk to these key people about the importance of this industry, the importance of Midland, because we're all aware that it's very easy for Midland-Odessa to get overlooked, whether it's in Austin or D.C., Burns said. He added that's a chance to highlight exactly what's going on in the Permian, exactly what our needs are, and as everyone knows, we still have transportation needs. We still have aviation needs. We have every other need that's really tied to the federal government. I think our trip has multiple things we want to achieve. we really want to get a message across, but at the same time, we want to make sure our neighbors have a chance to grow and get to know some of these people and can get directly to them. He said they are bringing several people from UTPB, including President Sandra Woodley. Burns said they want to encourage the students to get involved in the public service process. He added that the Odessa and Midland Chambers work well together and their interests are the same. We know we're stronger together than we are separate, and the truth is we're never separate. We're just not. Washington thinks of us as one area, one thing. We're not separated and never will be. I think it's just a natural for us, Burns said. This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for Saturday, March 19th. Law enforcement warns a variety of scams. For 5 weeks, Merle Dunn watched his wife Brenda clinging to life while battling COVID-19. She spent 11 days on a ventilator, and he begged God to spare her life. He did. To celebrate and to make Brenda's life easier, the couple decided to have their kitchen remodeled. So far, their life has only gotten more complicated. The Dunns believe they've fallen victim to a scam artist. Because Brenda, who is 72, remains tethered to an oxygen machine, the pair decided to open up their kitchen by knocking down a wall. They also decided to lower some cabinets, install a bar, and get rid of their popcorn ceiling. Brenda reached out to a friend, a real estate agent, for ideas on who to hire, and she recommended someone who had worked for a few of her clients. When the man gave her a quote $7,000 less than the first quote she received, Brenda agreed to hire him, thinking she could buy new appliances with the savings. After scraping a bit of their dining room ceiling, the contractor said he'd need $2,000 for supplies, including dust covers for their furniture, Brenda said. She wrote him a check for $2,000. A few days later, he showed her granite countertop samples from an Odessa store and informed her she'd have to pay in advance. After making her selection, she wrote another check, this one for $3,100. 2 weeks went by, and they didn't hear a word, Merle said. They tried texting and calling, but there was no response. Finally, the man called to say he'd just buried his dad, but he'd start the job immediately. Another 10 days went by, and still no word, Merle said. Merle, who spent 14 years as an Ector County Sheriff's deputy, decided it was time to go to the police after discovering the granite countertop had never been ordered. The sales staff had never heard of the contractor, and both checks had been cashed. Because the man scraped a small section of their ceiling, Merle said, he said he was told criminal charges could not be pursued. He'd have to file a small claims lawsuit. That, Merle said, is ridiculous. The retired Ector County Sheriff believes the man can be charged with fraud under Texas Penal Code Title 7, Section 32.53, which deals with the financial exploitation of children, elderly individuals, and disabled individuals. What that boy did meets all of the elements, Merle said. Merle has posted Facebook warnings about the man and hopes to convince a county or city prosecutor to take on the case. Word of the Facebook postings reached the man, and he called them on Monday, Brenda said. He asked me why we were calling him a thief, and I told him, because you are one, Brenda said. He hung up on her. When reached by phone Thursday, the man told the Odessa American he spent 5 hours scraping the Dunn ceiling, but every time he wanted to return to their home, they told him it wasn't a convenient day. He eventually gave up because he had other jobs lined up, he said. As for the granite countertop, he said he did purchase it, just not at the store he intended to, because it wasn't in stock. Of the $5,100 he received, he personally got $300. The rest went to supplies and materials, he said. The deal was I was supposed to work sun up until sundown, and I never got the opportunity, the man said. The contractor promised to send the OA the contract, he said, he provided Brenda, and several emails he exchanged with her. Emails, he said, will prove his version of the story. By Friday evening, he had not fulfilled his promise, and he stopped responding to texts. He did not answer phone calls, and his phone's voicemail box had not been set up to receive messages. The Dunns continued to insist they were ripped off. "There was no contract," Merle said. "This is embarrassing for me. I should have picked up on it as a former cop, but I wasn't there," he said. Although he's 72, Merle's still working to make sure his family is taken care of, and $5,100 is not an insignificant sum, he said. Despite being embarrassed, Merle said he is speaking out because he doesn't want anyone else to fall prey. He has no intention of filing a civil lawsuit because that would mean criminal charges could not be filed. "He screwed with the wrong person because I'm not going to settle until this gets resolved," Merle said. Odessa Police Department Detective Yolanda Medrano said when some work is done, situations like the Dunns have to be handled through the civil courts. "There are ways to avoid finding yourself in a similar predicament, though," she said. "First, always be suspicious of anyone calling you out of the blue or showing up at the door offering services," Medrano said. "And don't feel rushed to make a decision. Even if a potential contractor is offering you a huge discount if you act quickly," she said. "Take your time and do some research. People considering hiring a contractor can call the City of Odessa's Building Inspection Office to verify that they have a business license and are bonded and insured," Medrano said. Texas does not require general contractors, home improvement specialists, or people who perform handyman services to have a general contractor license, but they must have a business license. In addition, it's always a good idea to check references and with the Better Business Bureau. Contracts should be gone over closely, and the Better Business Bureau also recommends never paying more than 30% down on a project, Medrano said. "You should never make the final payment until the work is completely done," she said. According to an FBI report issued in 2020, their Internet Crime Complaint Center received nearly 792,000 complaints with reported losses exceeding $4.1 billion. Roughly 28% of the losses were sustained by victims over 60. This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for Saturday, March 19th. Oil companies aid Ukraine. Diamondback Energy is joining four other American oil and gas companies to donate $65 million to help meet the humanitarian needs of the people in Ukraine who have been displaced by the Russian invasion of their country. Diamondback spokesman Clint Williamson said Friday that a dozen nonprofit groups were being considered for the funding, but that their identities would not immediately be revealed because a security expert had advised the oil companies that the nonprofit groups could be subjected to cyber attacks. Diamondback Chairman and CEO Travis Stice said the donations are being made to help the millions of men, women, and children who have had to leave their homes as a result of this unjust war. "The money will go to organizations that are giving direct care and comfort to the people of Ukraine in this time of great need," Stice said in a news release. Williamson said the nonprofits will be named after they have gotten the money and put it to use. He said Diamondback is giving $10 million, Pioneer Natural Resources of Irving and Devon Energy of Oklahoma City, $20 million each. Civitas Resources of Denver, Colorado, $10 million, and Chesapeake Energy of Oklahoma City, $5 million. Diamondback Energy is an independent oil and natural gas company headquartered in Midland and focused on the acquisition, development, exploration, and exploitation of unconventional onshore oil and natural gas reserves in the Permian Basin, according to its website. Pioneer Natural Resources, which has a major presence in Midland, is engaged in hydrocarbon exploration in the Cline Shale and Spraberry Trend of the Permian Basin, its website says. This is Jane reading for Saturday, March 19th, Odessa American. Odessan pleads guilty, receives 20 years for child endangerment. An Odessa woman accused of allowing her young daughter to be raped over a three-year period in exchange for money was sentenced to 20 years in prison on Monday. According to court documents, Shirley Harmon, 40, pleaded guilty to abandonment and endangerment and was sentenced to the maximum term allowed under her plea agreement. She's still facing trial on one count each of continuous sexual assault and human trafficking. In January 2019, Child Protective Services received an anonymous tip that a 5-year-old girl told someone she knew that Gary Coleman Landreth, then 62, had sexually assaulted her. According to an Ector County Sheriff's Office report, the girl repeated the allegations to investigators, and a physical exam confirmed she'd been the victim of sexual assault. Landreth was arrested on suspicion of aggravated sexual assault of a child that same month. 6 months later, he was indicted along with the girl's mother. According to Ector County Sheriff's Office records, Harmon was indicted after an investigation revealed she'd accepted $400 from Landreth so he could have access to the girl. According to court documents, Harmon was initially indicted on continuous sexual abuse of a child and abandonment and endangerment, but she was later re-indicted on those charges, plus an additional charge of continuous trafficking of persons. According to the indictment, Harmon intentionally and knowingly caused Landreth to engage in sex acts with her daughter from August 2016 through January 2019, and she knowingly received a benefit from participating in a venture involving the trafficking of the child. The indictment further accused Harmon of intentionally abandoning her daughter under circumstances that placed her daughter in unreasonable risk of harm and under circumstances that a reasonable person would believe would place the child in imminent danger of death, bodily injury, or physical or mental impairment. Landreth is going on trial next week in Ector County District Court on 4 counts of aggravated sexual assault of a child, 1 count each of sex abuse of a child, continuous human trafficking, and injury to a child. This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for Saturday, March 19th. The other March Madness. Texas Tech's match day brings cheers. Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center School of Medicine students got their own taste of March Madness when they learned where they would go for their medical residency. 18 students were matched, which Regional Dean Dr. Timothy Benton said is about the regular number. The ritual where all was revealed was held Friday at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Students were surrounded by family and friends who anxiously awaited the results. Match Day is an annual event that takes place on medical school campuses nationwide. Match results are sealed in an envelope and opened simultaneously at all of the nation's medical schools as students learn where they will spend their next 3 to 7 years of their residency training, a news release said. Benton said medical school typically lasts 4 years, although it can be 3 if they are in an accelerated program. The COVID-19 pandemic required changes to medical schools across the country, with the 2022 residency recruitment, interview, and match processes. Due to the pandemic, this is the first class of students that completed their residency match without physically visiting the program location, the release said. Students applied to residency programs in their preferred specialties and visited sites virtually to evaluate and ultimately rank their preferred residency programs. The National Resident Matching Program coordinates this process, which is designed to produce results for students to fill the thousands of training positions available at U.S. teaching hospitals. Benton said this group is very successful in the match. Many have accomplished research projects and published papers, which would be in addition to their regular curricular work, classroom, and clinical operations, Benton said. Michael Calloway, Assistant Dean for Undergraduate Medical Education, said the students' curriculum was different. They were forced to go to pass-fail in the third year, which everyone was concerned about. Without ways to distinguish yourself, how are you going to impress the program directors? Turns out, probably a lot of the country had to do various things like that too, because they had to do various things to adapt and adjust, Calloway said. This class has been pretty impressive in terms of what that they've had to be more adaptable than most classes. I've had to give them props, and they were successful in the match. Nobody seemed to have been harmed by it. I think we all got a great education, he added. Grading is already back to the tiered grading system. It was pass-fail for the third year, Calloway said. That was just when the pandemic first started, and they had to start doing more and more stuff virtually. We had to do, basically, exams via Zoom, for instance, because we couldn't do very much in person other than that direct patient care. Obviously, that continued the way it was. There was a lot of anxiety about a lot of things, so we felt the best way to deal with that was simply to go to the pass-fail and really focus on the learning and not so much on the assessment and the grading, and basically rank ordering people, things like that. From an educational perspective, it was probably a good thing, Calloway said. Benton said Friday was a fantastic, fabulous day that the students have spent their lives to this point working for. In the 28 years since his March Madness day, his match day, Benton said his reward has come over and over. And so I hope you'll cherish this moment and cherish that thought of service to people, Benton said. Jeanette Calla was matched to family medicine at Texas Tech Health Sciences Center in Odessa. It was my first choice. During my clinical rotations here in Odessa made me really want to do my residence here as well because I felt like Texas Tech really embodies interprofessional education, Kayla said. As a medical student, she said she got to work with nursing and physician assistant students from Texas Tech, University of Texas Permian Basin, Odessa, and Midland Colleges. Originally from the Philippines, Calla's family moved to Pecos 8 years ago. But I really like West Texas, and after residency, I would like to stay in Texas, she said. Calla added that she grew up in a rural community, so she was drawn to family medicine. She said she enjoyed attending Texas Tech Health Sciences. I've worked with some of the residents here, the family medicine residents, and they really help each other. And I already have seniors that said they will help me when I start residency in July, Calla said. Amanda Bell from Greenwood was matched to internal medicine at Texas Tech in Lubbock. I'm really excited. Lubbock was my top choice, Bell said. I wanted to stay in West Texas. I really love the program director up there, and so I'm really excited that I get to stay near to family and stay in my West Texas community and get to be in a familiar place with familiar faces, Bell said. She added that the School of Medicine program gave her a lot of opportunities that she might have not have gotten at a larger medical center. Because we have a lot of faculty that are from the community, or they just volunteer their time from the community to take students without actually being on the faculty. They're very interested in their patients and in teaching upcoming physicians to care for those patients in the future, Bell said. She added that internal medicine is kind of the meat of medicine. I'm wanting to go into cardiology out of that, so that will be an additional fellowship on top of it. But it's something that I've always enjoyed from the start of medical school. It's kind of where I always pictured myself going into. I think it's just the best way that I can use the talents I've been given to help the people around me, Bell added. Nathan Van Roeder, who is from Snyder, brought his wife, Devon, to the Wagner Noel for the surprise. Van Roeder's specialty will be general surgery, and he was matched to St. Joseph's Hospital in Denver. I'm super excited. That was our number one choice, he said. He added that the program at Tech has always been awesome. You do 2 years in Lubbock, and then you move to Midland, and they kind of split us out, and you don't really know what to expect. And the Permian Basin campus has just been such a blessing for both me and my wife. The school itself has just been really taking the time to train up good physicians, and the community has been awesome. We found community with Redeemer Midland Church, and we've made some really good friends that make us sad to leave the Permian Basin at this point. Having grown up on a ranch, he added that he has always...
Hello, this is Michael, reading the Odessa American, published Sunday, March 20th, 2022. Front page. Murray says ECISD making progress, by Ruth Campbell. While Ector County ISD may not be at the level it would like, Superintendent Scott Murray says good things are happening in the district. In his State of the District address earlier in March, Murray said kindergartner readiness has increased by 13 percentage points. SAT scores were above the state level, and there was a 7% increase this year over last year in college, career, and military readiness. This is a factor in state accountability standards. We are now above the region, and we are now tied with the state of Texas. What that says to us is our students in ECISD coming from our five high schools are just as prepared as any other student in the state of Texas, Murray said. He noted that the 84.7% graduation rate is the highest in 20 years. Murray said he's not sure why college, career, and military readiness have increased and would have to dig more deeply to understand it. He added that it covers going to a 2 or 4 year college, technical school, or the military. Those data are generated from a variety of different things students do, everything from courses in which they engage to SAT scores to graduation rates. There's a lot of factors that influence CCMR, so I'd have to understand exactly what happened in the state to know why theirs dropped, Murray said. But broadly, there were many schools in Texas in which kids were not attending school for many, many months. And remember, we, in August of 2020, we started going back to school. So we have kids from the first day of school, and then we phased in, and not every district in Texas did that. Many were out for months. That affected kids, and we've seen that. We were fortunate that we were able to start when we did. Our kids have benefited because of that, he said. Murray said 2.5 years ago, the district was at 56%. It is now 63% in college, career, and military readiness, which is part of measuring college readiness. It is the percentage of high school students that are prepared for post-secondary success. When you think about it, in the state of Texas, 70% of our jobs require some form of post-secondary credential, and 63 is not 70. So even though we feel good because we've increased by 7%, we're still not where we need to be based upon the job market in our state. So if somebody says, the state is still bad, well, yeah, we're below where we should be, absolutely as a state, because the state is at 63 as well, Murray said. The goal of the ECISD Board of Trustees is to reach 65% by 2024, and they are at 63%. I'm pretty confident we're going to hit the 65 by 2024, so that's good. So we have been real pleased with that, Murray said. Many times when a high school student receives a diploma at graduation, districts are done with them. In ECISD, that just can't be the case. We have to make sure that our kids continue to be successful. We created a new department called the To and Through Department, and the To is getting our kids to that next step. So to college, to the military, to a technical school, but then through it. We recognize that while some of our kids get to, many of them didn't make it through. And sometimes they, at the end of that first semester, they run out of money. And they're not sure where to get more money, so they just come home. Or it's hard. Post-secondary college is hard. Technical school can be difficult. Sometimes you pick up the phone and call home. And if you're calling a family that perhaps hasn't had a post-secondary experience themselves, they may not know how to advise you. And so today, we now have, instead of calling home, you could actually call ECISD while you're a freshman in college or a sophomore in college, and we can give you some advice on perhaps where you could find additional funds to continue your education, or if you're having a rough time struggling with your academic studies, where you could go on your campus to find support, how to find a tutor, etc. Kind of give kids the encouragement that they need to make it through that post-secondary experience. So that's the office of the To and Through, all about supporting our graduates, our alumni, if you will, in their journey to make it through a post-secondary experience, Murray said. Murray also recently attended the South by Southwest education event in Austin. Big learnings from South by Southwest. There was a lot of conversation about the social-emotional learning needs of our kids. I see them here. I am listening to our kids and our teachers and administrators just to understand the struggles that kids in our own community are facing. But just the realization that we have leaders and teachers from all over the country in North, South, East, and West. So the struggles that our kids are facing, the trauma from the pandemic, has dramatic effects on kids across the country and continues. In many cases, kids continued to suffer mightily because of that. And so we're not alone in this. So that realization that those social emotional issues are affecting kids and in some pretty significant ways, and our efforts to support kids in that area continue to be important, he said. Broadband and really thinking about the tomorrow of school was interesting. So takeaways there. As a community, we're doing some exceptional work to bring high-speed, affordable broadband to our own community, but also just listening to the challenges and opportunities that other communities are facing. So some good learning there. There's some creative solutions that folks are tackling, but there's still a lot of people searching for what those opportunities can be. It was nice to be able to share our story with others and then have other people have that light bulb experience in which some other communities took away some good learning and some ideas that can go back to their communities, Murray added. On the future of education, he said there was a lot of conversation about what the next iteration of education, specifically the role of adults in education, could be. We've been, for well over 100 years, in the model of one teacher and 25 kids, and that makes a classroom at the elementary, middle, and high school level. But today in our society, we don't have enough of those adults to support kids in the traditional way that we've done school. In Ector County, we've had a teacher shortage for a long time, so we're having to be creative today with how we think about teaching and learning. Now the problem that we had long before the pandemic started is everyone else's problem as well. And so, talking with other thought leaders and what is the next iteration of education as we deal with this critical staffing shortage, we still have to continue to educate kids at a high level. But if we don't have enough adults to do that, the way that we've traditionally done it, then how do you create new models of learning that allow kids to continue to accelerate their learning, but also with a different type of adult? Those conversations are interesting, and we're having a lot of those in Texas right now, Murray said. He added that a lot of people were amazed that innovation was taking place in West Texas, especially on the broadband and human capital fronts. Murray said, when we told people ECISD had 350 teacher vacancies 2.5 years ago before the pandemic, and now there are about 50, that prompted shock and awe. There was a lot of surprise that innovation can happen in rural Texas, rural West Texas. Good things are happening. So yes, lots of surprise. Lots of people asking, where's Ector County? Murray said. On a separate item, Executive Director of Talent Development, Ashley Osborne, was chosen for a statewide teacher shortage task force. Again, we're doing some interesting things here because we have faced it for years. The state and the governor's office, they've paid attention to what's happening here. We're getting results. It's one thing to have a good idea, but when your good idea generates results that are positive, people want to know more. And so the task force that Ashley is on has already had their first meeting, and that meeting was March 10th. So that group of leaders across the state convened. In that first meeting, Ector County ISD was lifted up as one of the two exemplar districts that are actually tackling the human capital issue with great success, Murray said. And so our story was told yesterday, and it kind of caught Ashley by surprise. She had no idea that in the first meeting, some of the work that she's leading in this system is being shared widely across the state. But that's why we're at the table. People recognize what's happening, and they want to hear more about what we're doing and how we're solving this human capital crisis. On the strategic plan, Murray said he talked to some senior leaders about it. Murray arrived at ECISD 2.5 years ago, and he started off by looking, listening, and learning to understand what was happening. First, you get to know the problem and then develop a plan. Year two is roll out the plan, so there's a whole lot of new. New people, new ideas, new projects, new programs, new software. People are just overwhelmed with new. But when you get to year three, it is taking those projects and programs that are no longer new, but ensuring that they are implemented with fidelity. We're in year three of our strategic plan. In this year, we should be feeling some resistance to some things because now it is starting to stick and people thought, hey, maybe this will go away and it's not going away. Now's the time when you take that good idea and make it great. Now's the time that you clean the corners. You make sure that those ideas and programs that were implemented are now being implemented with fidelity, that we're refining and taking any kind of corrective actions that need to be taken so that we start humming, if you will, as an organization. We're in year three, Murray said. This is the year in the strategic plan where the time frame is pretty difficult because it's all about improvement. We're not introducing new, we are refining, and sometimes when you refine, it affects people and causes them to have to change a little bit, and that change work can be scary for folks. It's all about making ourselves better, but we're in year three, and that is refinement. We see what's working, and then we make it work a little bit better. And then we see what's not working, and maybe we shed some things that we thought was a good idea, but maybe that wasn't a good idea. And so we do some retooling, he added. He said they have encountered some of the resistance they were expecting, but they have to push through it. We are experiencing success with many of the initiatives that we're doing, but it's hard work, and sometimes that's where you face resistance. Well, this is too hard. It takes too much time. It's too late. All of that may be true. It may be difficult, and it may be time-consuming. But it's the right kind of work to do for kids. It's the right kind of work to do for adults. And we have to press forward to go from good to great. And that's hard work, Murray said. Organizationally, he said, you are always losing people. You're always gaining people as well. The goal is to make sure that we retain the most effective teachers, the most effective principals, the most effective custodians, etc. That's the goal, and then those individuals in the organization that don't buy into the vision, or that don't support the vision, or that don't have the capacity to work within this vision, those are the folks that along the journey sometimes make different decisions, and then the goal is also to attract people, Murray said. He added that compensation has increased significantly for teachers, and that attracts people. Opportunity culture has been implemented at 17 campuses. 3 more will be implemented next year. According to its website, opportunity culture extends the reach of excellent teachers and their teams to more students for more pay within budget. Teachers gain time to plan and collaborate. Everyone gets more support. And students get high standards, personalized instruction. In August of 2022, there will be 20 schools that will have full implementations of opportunity culture. And then next year, we'll open up the cohort again and have another group that will commit. So I can't tell you how many new ones we'll have that will start next year, but the goal for that initiative is not for every school. It's right for some and not others. And so it's an opt-in for schools that want to use it, Murray said. There are some campuses that don't want to opt in. Some schools don't need the benefit of opportunity culture, or it's just a strategy that doesn't make sense for their campus. They've chosen a different strategy to improve, and that's fine. That this is not an initiative you want to force on people. It's all about the coalition of the willing, who wants to do this, and what campus does it make sense for, Murray said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.